We talked about geodesics in Schwarzschild, and I showed you just, this sort of Hamilton-Jacobi approach to finding geodesics, where you essentially you identify conserved quantities, you end up solving ODEs or separable differential equations. So we're going to kind of pick up on that theme. And we're going, I mean, the main aim of today is actually, showing you how Penrose diagrams are constructed, because you will probably see them all over the place in books or in talks. And it's a sort of way in which we encode what is going on causally in a space-time. In other words, what's sort of future, past, and what's the light cone structure. But first, I just wanted to finish off, if you like, the discussion about Kerr and the horizon of Kerr, because I talked about the ergosphere where GTT went to zero, so inside which it was not possible to remain stationary with respect to infinity. So this, note the way this is written, you've got this delta which vanishes. Now at two points, there's two roots of this equation, but when delta goes to zero, you've got something going on blowing up with dr squared. And the way this is kind of ordered, this is writing it in one way of writing it as an orthonormal basis, but it's paired things up so that you see something that looks like a Schwarzschild structure here, and something that looks like an S2 type of functional behavior there. So the suggestion is, from this way of writing it, that delta going to zero is the horizon. So we just want to confirm that. And I'm just going to give an argument about looking at geodesics. So an event horizon is a causal boundary. It's the boundary between what you can see at infinity and what you can't. And so if you can find a geodesic from a point out to infinity, then that is outside the event horizon. So just to note that in Kerr, right, just as in Schwarzschild, that if you have a geodesic in the equator, it remains in the equatorial plane. So from our geodesic equation, restricting it to the equatorial plane now, this is our geodesic equation. So just noticing, just to point out a couple of differences and similarities with Schwarzschild, you see that the angular momentum has been altered by a piece which is related to the time component, the energy, if you like, of the particle. And notice how that sort of, if here, h is telling you about, your angular momentum, whether it's going in a plus direction or a minus direction. So in other words, h changes sign according to whether something's going clockwise or counterclockwise, relative, let's say, to the North Pole. Now, in Schwarzschild, that doesn't really matter, because you could just flip over from the other pole, if you like. But in Kerr, because you have a preferred orientation, dt d phi is non-zero and has a fixed sign, it means that if you swap the sign of h, you get a sort of different magnitude here. So in essence, this term is picking out co and counter rotating geodesics. So just to note that you see the rotation sort of showing up there. So my effective potential So if we track where that term lands, we see that that term lands in the GR piece. So, you know, what this is telling you is that this phenomenon of the rotation of the space-time is a general relativistic one. It's this frame-dragging effect. So you sort of see that showing up in this last term here. So the ergosphere is obviously a general relativistic effect. So I wanted to convince you that delta equals zero was the horizon. So let me look at null geodesics, because that's the fastest we can go, the speed of light. So for null geodesics, I've got this relation. And so what I want to look at is I want to consider, I'm just going to make things easy. I'm going to consider the limit in which these two coincide, and this is really just to make the algebra easier for presenting on the board. So you see there are two roots, and as you increase a, so if a was zero, the root, there's one root and it's 2gm, that's Schwarzschild. As you increase a, then you eventually get the two roots coming together when a is equal to gm. So I'm going to look at the point where r dot squared is zero, because that is, if you like, a turning point on a light ray. So if I imagine, you know, we talked about this with impact parameters last time. If I imagine a light ray coming from near the black hole, well, it's not going to come from inside, so the chances are it's come from some minimum value of r. It's been scattered by the black hole. So let's say this is at some r0. So I'm just going to label that minimum value of r. And at the moment, r0 is going to be bigger than or equal to a, which is bigger than or equal to r plus. Okay, so if r dot squared is zero, then that tells me that this v is zero. So in other words, one is equal to this combination of HA and R0. But then I can pull out the common factor of H minus A. I'm just really trying to simplify the expression. And I see now, if I look inside here, this is solved by R0 is equal to H minus A. So I've now got a bound on H for this scattered light ray. H has to be bigger than or equal to 2a. So now let me just see what happens to the light ray, my v primed at this value of r0. So I take the derivative of my potential and I get this. I then substitute R0 as H minus A. So you see there's going to be some cancellations here. So in other words, my V primed is negative at this value of R0. So here, if I plot my V, this is R0, where R dot squared is 0. And so my V decreases away from that point. So in other words, that tells me from the motion, you know, if I think of my analogy of the geodesic finding solutions is motion of a particle in that potential well, that tells me the geodesic will escape to infinity. And so what you notice there is that I can take R0 all the way down to that root A, and, you know, obviously as it reaches A, then the gradient of the potential vanishes. So it's, you know, that sort of is a limit where the geodesic doesn't escape, but precisely. So in other words, every geodesic at every point outside delta equals zero, you can find a geodesic that gets to infinity. You just have to choose a relevant angular momentum parameter. So that tells you that R0 equals A is the boundary between geodesics that do escape to infinity and those that don't. And right at R0 equals A, there will be a geodesic that stays there always. It's always trying to escape, but it never quite can. And that is the event horizon. So you can do the same calculation for a more general value of A, but it just adds to the algebra without really changing the argument qualitatively. So this tells us that the event horizon is a null surface. Again, it's this boundary between things that escape and things that don't, and so our intuition is that we could make up, or we could describe the event horizon by this sort of barrage of photons, each of which are constantly trying to run away from the center of the black hole, but they never actually get any further away because they're being pulled back in. So our event horizon is a null surface. And so we encode this in GR by a picture, a diagram that tells us about the causal structure of the black hole. Is that a couple of questions? It's not Monday morning anymore, is it? Yeah, go on.
I missed what H is.
H is the angular momentum. So if you refer back to Monday, we defined it there. It's, but intuitively, it's angular momentum. Yeah.
It relates to like J parameter?
No, J is the angular momentum of the black hole.
Oh,
H is the angular momentum of whatever it is that's following the geodesic, be it a particle or a photon. So, yeah, I mean, if you don't aim something directly at the black hole, but if you aim it off to the side, it will have angular momentum. Yeah.
You made a comment about the more general approach, but if we had two routes, because we had one route because we took the limit where I go to GM, would we have two types of null surfaces or something like that?
So the outermost one is our event horizon, because that's the one, that's the first one we meet, if you like, as we go in. Inside the event horizon, there is an inner horizon, which is more accurately referred to as a Cauchy horizon. Once we've finished doing the Penrose diagram, you can bring me back to it and I'll draw it and comment on it again. But there is an internal horizon. And so actually, by the time we get to R equals zero, if you think about Schwarzschild, so let me just rewrite down Schwarzschild, because that's what I'm going to discuss for the Penrose diagram. So you notice as we go to R less than 2 GM, I've obviously been thinking about it there, sorry. the sign of GTT and GRR flip. So it's as if time is becoming a spatial coordinate and R is becoming a time coordinate. So inside the black hole, R equals zero is now a space-like surface because R is a sort of time coordinate. And so our singularity in Schwarzschild is space-like. But if we think about this here, we sort of get one sign flip as we go through the outer route. So we swap our role of spatial and time-like coordinates. But then we get another flip of sign as we go through R minus, so we've gone back to T being a time-like coordinate again. So R equals zero is now a time-like surface because it has a space-like normal. So it changes the nature of the singularities inside the black hole, and it sort of gives rise to the fact that if we, as we're about to discuss, maximally extend these black holes, it looks like you can go through and then come out in a new universe. So, fun for science fiction films. So let's actually see some of that in action. So our first, you may have seen some of these steps, but I believe you haven't seen the whole story. Our first step is to define the tortoise coordinate. The reason we do this is really because what we want to do is to have a nice set of coordinates for our null geodesics. So if I now write 1 minus 2 gm over r as f of r, just for simplicity, I'm going to write 2 gm as r plus, again, just to save on writing, then my metric looks like f into dt squared minus dr star squared, etc. So if I want to solve for a radial null geodesic, it's going to be t equals r star plus a constant, or t is minus r star plus a constant. So this is done for convenience, for looking at the wave equation in essence. So then, I'm going to define some new null coordinates. So I take these simple null coordinates, t plus or minus r star, and I exponentiate them. Why do I do that? That's because if I just took the simple, obvious null coordinates, t and r star, I would still have a coordinate singularity at 2gm. So instead, what I do is I resolve that singularity. Because here, if I look at what happens to my coordinates, as r goes to r plus, we know that r star tends to minus infinity. And so at fixed t, u and v tend to zero. But if I set t being proportional to r star, in this case minus r star, then both t and r star go to sort of blow up on the horizon, but my u tends to zero, but v remains finite. So note that uv is equal to minus r plus squared, e to the r star over r plus. So this is just a function of r, and as r star tends to minus infinity, uv tends to zero. So we're sort of identifying our horizon with particular properties of u and v. So the real reason we exponentiate comes from looking at the metric. So here, my du dv, which is now, if at least from the perspective of capital U, capital V coordinates, is regular, looks like e to the r star over r plus times dt squared minus dr star squared. But e to the r star over r plus has some sort of function that's varying mildly near r plus. But you pick up this log. So e to the r star over r plus is just going to look like r minus 2gm on 2gm. In other words, it's proportional to that function f. Yeah. So my du dv looks like f times dt squared minus dr star squared with some extra little bits and pieces going on. But basically, my metric now is going to be something regular times du dv. And therefore, what I've done is I've changed to a coordinate chart, which now has no problem with r equals r plus. It's completely regular. So here, if I put in the details, my ds squared for Schwarzschild is now 8gm on r, e to the minus r on r plus, du, dv, minus r squared, d omega squared. So it's now completely regular. So I believe you saw these null coordinates in the first GR course, and this was like the first step towards people beginning to understand the structure of the black hole. So these, Eddington introduced the, I guess, the T plus R star coordinate. But it wasn't really until the 60s that people kind of really nailed this, this description of the event horizon and made this analytic continuation. So here we start off, U is negative. So if I sketch my the new coordinates, this is my minus U. So U is strictly negative in our original Schwarzschild patch, and V is positive. So that is this quadrant here. But there's absolutely no reason to stop at this line. And notice along this line here, UV is zero. So that is the event horizon. That's R equals R plus. But there's no reason to stop there. So we can just use these UV coordinates. We can go across here. We can go across here. And we can also go into the other patch. So we now have a regular coordinate system, a chart, that covers all the way out to infinity on both sides. But if we look inside this light cone, we have to sort of think what happens to U and V. So let's just look. R equals constant corresponds to UV equals constant. So that those are hyperboloids. T equals constant is U over V equals constant. R equals R plus, we already said, was UV is zero. And R equals zero is UV equals R plus squared. So if I look at that, my R equals constant lines are these hyperbole. So this is R equals constant. Find some colors here. Then T equals constant is just a straight line over there. So this is my R and T equals constant. Oh, there's only two colors. I thought there was this lovely beigey color before. Here it is. Ideally, I'd like red, but there isn't red, I don't think so. Okay. And then finally, R equals zero is one of these hyperbole, which is UV equals R plus squared. Which is R equals zero. So I've drawn it as a wiggly line because R equals zero is just singular and there's nothing we can do about it. It's singular even in the UV coordinates. So this is the causal picture of our black hole. But of course, it's an infinite picture in the sense that UV range over the full real line. So just a couple of comments. The event horizon is now this light cone. It's UV is zero. So it looks, we've got two branches here. So as I said before, if T is T0 minus R star, then U tends to zero at finite V. And we call this the future event horizon, because it really is an event horizon. It is saying that, you know, this is when T goes to infinity, so anything on the other side of it we can't see. But we also have a branch where V goes to zero and U is finite. And we kind of label this the past event horizon. But in essence, this is not actually part of a physical space-time of a physical black hole, because a black hole, we believe, will form from some sort of collapse process. And therefore, it never has this sort of other half. We only ever have the future part of the picture. But again, you might sort of see that this might be called the white hole, because nothing from our past, our Schwarzschild patch, can actually get into this region. So we typically abbreviate and say that we're looking at Penrose diagrams of black holes, but Brandon Carter was also quite involved in this, in the sort of development of this particular shorthand, or rather nice way of drawing black holes. So I'm going to define a new chart. Again, this is going to be a global chart in the sense that it covers the full space-time. But what it's done is it's shrunk down the infinite range of U and V into a finite range of P and Q. So here, V being in, example, minus infinity, infinity, in other words, V is a real number, goes to P in minus pi on 2. So this preserves, because you're sort of squeezing up the V and squeezing up the U, this preserves null geodesics. So it's a conformal transformation, but it's singular in a sense, because it brings an infinite range down to finite size. So here, if we do, for example, V is zero corresponds to P is zero, and U is R plus corresponds to Q is pi on 4, so just some sample values. another relation we'll need. So we don't end up with a diamond here, right? Because the diamond would be the full potential range of P and Q, where they each went from minus pi on 2 to pi on 2. Because we have the singularity sitting here at UV equals R plus squared. And when UV equals R plus squared, this denominator goes to zero. So in other words, P plus Q goes to pi on 2. So my diamond is going to be cut off when P plus Q equals pi on 2. So here, this is, which one is this? This is P is pi on 2, Q is 0. No, hang on. I think I need to know where my 0 is. Let me draw it here. There's my 0. So this point here is P is pi on 2, Q is 0. This point here is P is 0, Q is pi on 2. So we kind of get P plus Q equals pi on 2 is just a straight line going across. So if I sketch my P and Q, so this is what I get. I truncate that diamond because of the singularity. That sort of stops the picture at P plus Q is pi on 2. So this is my Penrose diagram. I drew my P and Q, and then I kind of just delete the parts of the diagram that don't correspond. And this is a chart that covers the full maximally extended Schwarzschild spacetime, which is compact. So I just want to now talk about a little bit about this. This actually encodes the full causal structure of the black hole. We have those R equals constant lines now look like this. T equals constant now looks like this. And my singularity, I've already sketched that. So now let me look at these points here. This one here is T going to infinity at finite R. And this is labeled iota naught, sorry, iota plus, which is future time-like infinity. That sort of makes sense. It's where you end up if you're a massive particle. This one here is t goes to minus infinity at a fixed R, and this is I minus, which is past time-like infinity. So that's dealing with what happens when you go to infinity in time. This one here is spatial infinity. And that's I naught. And then you can also go to infinity in a null direction. So here, a light rays are always at 45 degrees. So this is where all light rays end up. So this is a null infinity. So this is, if you like, T and R go to infinity. So this is called scry plus, which is future null infinity. And here, this is where all in light rays would come from. So that's like T goes to minus infinity. And this is scry minus, which is past null infinity. So you see that infinity becomes really quite a complex thing in relativity. So just a few other examples. Minkowski space-time. So here we have simple null coordinates, and so R being positive tells us that V is bigger than or equal to U, and so what we get here is half of the plane, so U so if we do this same shrinking, the arctangent, we get the Penrose diagram that looks like this. So remember, Penrose diagrams here are just two-dimensional representations, and what we've done is we've suppressed the theta and phi. So over every single point on that little triangle there, that flag, there's a two-sphere, and the radius of the two-sphere, the local radius, is the local R coordinate. So you have to sometimes be careful, which people are nowadays a bit more careful, about thinking about the symmetries. The reason we can reduce it to a two-dimensional sketch is because we have spherical symmetry, so we can suppress the theta and phi directions. It's not always possible. So if I have a lambda, my F is now has an extra piece. That's we talked about that when we talked about black holes. And so, for example, in De Sitter, we have two horizons. And so, without doing the calculation, you start to sort of say, how do I build up this black hole picture? Well, I start off, I'm still going to have something that looks like the same the same black hole horizon. So I'm still going to have something like this. But then I have a second horizon. Now, horizons are null surfaces, so I draw a second light cone. So this is the cosmological horizon. But now I sort of see that there's no reason to stop. You know, I can't just, my space-time doesn't stop. I analytically continue across there and back over, so I kind of just keep going. I get this sort of infinite, because we know de sitter's compact, we would just kind of roll it back on itself. And then traditionally, people have sort of drawn future infinity as just being a line along here. However, it's not quite true in the sense of it's not necessarily the case that you can make both the singularity and the future event horizon flat. And I'm trying to remember which way they bulge, but maybe that one bulges out. So from a classical perspective, it doesn't matter, but if you're thinking about correlations across horizons, then that will have an impact. So that's de sitter. ADS is similar. You have the horizon, the singularity, and then you have some form of boundary at infinity, which is, again, not necessarily straight. So I got a question earlier about what happens with an inner horizon. So let me play that game again. Here is my event horizon and my null infinity. So I can imagine having the extension over to the other side. But now inside, I have a second null surface at R minus. So I just draw yet another light cone crossing. And then my singularity, I said I had a singularity inside R equals R minus, but what was a space-like singularity now becomes a time-like one, and so on and so forth. So this is the Penrose diagram for Kerr or, well, equatorial Kerr, or Reisner-Nordström, because both of those have an outer horizon and an inner horizon. And so, in essence, you start to learn to just build up these pictures of the causal structure of the pure space-time, maximally extended. That doesn't mean that's actually what happens physically, because if you imagine matter falling through the event horizon, as you go up to this horizon, the matter will get blue-shifted. So there's all sorts of work on whether these inner horizons are really stable, whether they become singular. But at least from the mathematical perspective of the space, the structure of the solution, the exact solution, that is what happens. So I'm just going to change tack slightly. So I'm just going to wait and see if there's any questions. Yeah.
I have a question about the singularity. Mm-hmm. In Schwarzschild, for example, the curvature scalars at r equals zero were divergent. Mm-hmm. Is the same true for the Kerr case?
So I think the Kerr, it's one of these sort of slightly bizarre singularities that you only see it, I think, if you approach on with a geodesic on the equatorial plane. However, it's one of these sort of things where you have a mathematical sort of statement about a structure of a singularity, but then if you think about the physics of it, you know, mathematically you've got zero, you know, point objects, things that have zero volume. We don't have that in physics, right? So the Kerr actually has quite an interesting singularity structure. In some ways it looks kind of like a ring. So it looks like you can kind of send a geodesic through on the pole. It would be absolutely bang on target, but it has to have zero extent. So, you know, the singularity structures are a bit bizarre with Kerr. In fact, Kerr is more bizarre, you know, than you might think it is at first sight. Well, I mean, it looks more, you know, it certainly looks less straightforward than Schwarzschild, but the more you dig into it, you know, the more it seems to kind of surprise you or whatever. Yeah. So I just wanted to finish off with, again, returning to Kerr. So if we ask what is the area of the Kerr event horizon, because of the r plus squared plus a squared here inside multiplying the phi, it's the area is not 4 pi r plus squared. It has an extra piece coming from the a squared. But it's still less than the area of a Schwarzschild black hole of the same mass. So what I want to just ask is, this is an exact solution. What happens if I throw something into the black hole? What happens to the solution? Then my black hole will settle down to another Kerr solution with a new R plus and a new A, where we expect those R plus to be, the new R plus to be close to the old one. So in other words, I just have a slight change in R plus, and the new A should be close to the old A, so I just have a little change in A. So now I'm going to use this expression for R plus here, the root, to express that in terms of delta m. So I've changed my R plus, delta R plus, into something which tracks the two parameters, the M and the A, of my Kerr metric. And then I'm just going to group together these terms. Right, so now I've expressed the change in the area in terms of a change in the mass parameter and a change in this A parameter. But A is just a parameter in the metric. It's not necessarily a charge of the black hole. So I note that A is J over M, where I can express both J and M as sort of integrals or charges of the space-time, one being the mass and one being the angular momentum. I don't want a delta A because A is just a parameter in the metric. I want to relate it to some more physical property of the black hole. And the other thing that I'm going to need when I'm doing this manipulation is to have an expression which again has some sort of interpretation in terms of physical properties of the black hole, which is the angular velocity of the horizon. So angular velocities are really talking about this ratio of g phi t over g phi phi. Okay, so let's now come back to what is delta A. So I'm going to just divide by 8 pi here. So because A is J over M, my delta A is delta J over M minus J delta M over M squared, which is, of course, minus A over M delta M. So that's kind of where this term has come from. This has come from the A delta A piece. But then I can just sort of pull things together here. This is g delta m into r plus squared plus a squared. So that's the reason for actually peeling off this angular velocity of the horizon. What I'm looking for here is to make a sort of common factor on the right-hand side. We've got the common factor of dividing by r plus minus gm. Here I've got, I see very straightforwardly, I have an r plus squared plus a squared. But then here I've just got a, but then I notice that this is this angular velocity of the horizon. And so if I rearrange, I get delta M is some constant times delta A. Plus omega delta j. So if I compare this with the first law of thermodynamics, I've got something that really actually looks quite familiar. So this mu dq, here we've got omega and j. We don't have a P term, but here I'm going to identify ds with delta A over 4g and t with that prefactor. So this was the argument used by Bekenstein to try to restore the second law of thermodynamics as far, you know, to astrophysics and cosmology. Because the problem seemed to be that if you had a black hole, you could throw a load of junk into it, a lot of information, thereby reducing the entropy in your exterior region. And if the black hole didn't carry entropy, you would be violating the second law of thermodynamics, which was something that makes you feel rather uncomfortable. And so if you look at what happens within the curve family of solutions, you see, well, actually, if I identify area with entropy, then I can now preserve my first law, or preserve the second law, sorry, of thermodynamics, because, you know, then the black hole can carry entropy, so it has some sort of budget. However, the constant, the 1/4, was not known. It was just some arbitrary constant until Stephen Hawking did the calculation for Schwarzschild and found that the transformation of between the Hilbert space on the past horizon and future horizon was effectively that of a thermal bath at that temperature. So that fixed the constant of proportionality. And here there are no H-bars, but in essence, when you put H-bars in, you get an H-bar here and an H-bar there. And so you see that the entropy of a black hole is absolutely huge. And so it's about a max, it's the maximal possible entropy that could be carried. And so this was, you know, I guess, up until Hawking radiate, the Hawking calculation came out, it was more of a way of trying to say, don't worry about these fictional objects that probably don't exist, sort of swallowing up all the entropy in the universe, because actually, yes, you can assign an entropy to them in a way that is consistent with the second law of thermodynamics. And then it was realized, you know, you have a first law of thermodynamics for black holes. And there was a paper by Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking, where they look at objects in falling from infinity. So at asymptotic infinity, you know the energy of a particle, and you know its angular momentum, and so you can kind of track that going into the black hole, and you see that this first law holds. And of course, now black hole thermodynamics has sort of really taken on a life of its own. So we'll pick up that thought on Friday, where I'll talk more about the partition function approach to black hole thermodynamics and a sort of, you know, it's about Euclidean quantum gravity. It's not going to go really to the frontiers of quantum gravity. This was what people tried first. It doesn't quite work, but you can actually get a lot of sensible answers out of it, provided you're just a bit careful. And so we'll pick that up on Friday. We'll need to talk about actions. We'll need to talk about boundary terms in actions and how we regularize the action of different space-times.